listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
They say everything can be replaced, yet every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my light come shining from the west unto the east. Any day now, I shall be released. They say every man needs protection. They say that every man must fall. Yet I swear I see my reflection someplace so high above this wall. I see my light come shining from the west unto the east. Any day now, I shall be released. Standing next to me in this lonely crowd is a man who swears he's not to blame. All day long I hear him shout so loud, crying out that he was framed. I see my light come shining from the west unto the east. Any day now, I shall be released. Well, any day now, Fort Lauderdale will be released from the reign of Liar Seiler, our anti-homeless mayor. But as a result of the election this week, that day will not be for another 3 years. With a pitiful turnout of just about 7% of the voters, the mayor was rammed right back up, the mayor was reelected by a big margin. And so it goes. Other places have more violent or urgent problems. Near the University of North Carolina this week, a gunman shot down 3 young Muslims. But the police assured everybody it wasn't a hate crime or terrorism or anything like that. How do you think that would play if the shooter was Muslim and the victims were white Christians? Just saying. Meanwhile, NATO and the Western nations must be heartbroken that Putin is agreeing to a ceasefire in Ukraine. Won't we get a chance to scramble those warthogs we sent over to Germany? Oh, we can't wait to unleash Operation Atlantic Resolve. Of course, we're pretending to be happy about the agreement, but we know that Ruski won't keep his word. We can guarantee it. We will make sure of it. Wink, wink. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Listener-supported network. Visit freedomslips.com and check them out. It's a crazy world we live in. I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome back special guests Jim Fetzer, Richard Flamer, Phil Ferruggio, and Susan Lindauer. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Port Orange, Chiapas, Mexico, Madison, Wisconsin, Tacoma Park, Maryland, and wherever you are. I want to make a special note of a film you can see online for free. It's called Counterintelligence, Shining a Light on Black Operations. Scott Noble, Metanoia Films, 2013, Part 1, 2, 3. Free at Metanoia, M-E-T-A-N-O-I-A, -films.org. And we are presenting a truth book series, Save the World, Resist the American Empire. The first book, The Dynamic Duo, a biography of Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, is completed and available. And in process is a book showing that nobody died of Sandy Hook of Boston. Next will come a book that will explore the questions of whether we went to the moon, and whether the Holocaust happened as we are being told, also whether Paul McCartney, the real one, died a long time ago. The fourth book will show that nuclear weapons were used by Israel and persons within the U.S. government on the World Trade Center towers, and that the U.S. media is guilty of being an integral part of a domestic Operation Gladio and cataloging and explaining the rash United States false flag, false terror events in recent years. The entire series, entitled Save the World, Resist the American Empire, is scheduled for release in 2015. And here's something. The Daughters of the New American Revolution are presenting a free showing of the new movie, The Plowshares Movement, More Patriotic Than All Your Phony Military Crap, by Ken Burns, Tom Hanks, and Doris Kearns Goodwin. A preview. In 1980, several members of the Atlantic Life community carried out the first plowshares action, symbolically disarming MX missiles by hammering their nose cones at the General Electric facility in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. The subsequent trial involved eight defendants: Philip Berrigan, Daniel Berrigan, Carl Cabot, John Shushart, Dean Hammer, Elmer Moss, and Montgomery and Molly Rush. The group's name had been suggested by these lines from the Old Testament prophet Isaiah: and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. By 2006, 80 plowshares groups, unfurling banners on warships and pouring blood on plans for other peacekeepers, had entered various weapons facilities along the East Coast from Maine to Florida, throughout the Midwest and Southwest, in England, Ireland, Scotland, Germany, and Australia. On Easter Sunday, 1991, at 3:45 a.m., for example, five Aegis plowshares, Kathy Boylan, Tom Lewis, Barry Roth, Philip Berrigan, and Daniel Sicken, climbed onto the USS Gettysburg, harbored at Bath, Maine, hammered on missile launchers, poured blood, and unfurled banners across the gunguns. They also posted an indictment charging President Bush and other military chiefs with violations of religious, domestic, and international law in deploying weapons of mass destruction, such as the Tomahawk missile. Similarly, in April 2002, three Dominican nuns, sisters Carol Gilbert, Jackie Hudson, and Artie Platt, symbolically disarmed a nuclear missile silo in Colorado. The most recent plowshares action, the Transform Now plowshares, Sister Megan Rice, Michael Wally, and Greg Borchi, were convicted of sabotage at the Oak Ridge Nuclear Weapons Complex and sentenced to 62 months in federal prison. Please come out to the Legion Hall, buy an apple pie, and support the Daughters of the New American Revolution.
A New American Dream Radio Show news note regarding the NBC internal investigation of Brian Williams. NBC News President Deborah Ternus announced the internal investigation in a memo to staff this past Friday. As you would expect, we have a team dedicated to gathering the facts to help us make sense of all that has transpired, Ternus wrote. We're working on what the best next steps are, and when we have something to communicate, we will, of course, share it with you. That's so cool. Deborah Ternus, the president of NBC, that's way up there, pretty high in American society, and she's going to investigate that one of her star reporters lied to the American people. That's so awesome. We're pretty sure by the time she's done, she'll tell us why NBC colluded with the CIA and the Israeli Mossad, produced the 9/11 hoax and production, the fake Boston bombing, and Sandy Hook. This is so cool. We can't wait. It is so cool because NBC is investigating itself, and they're going to tell us the truth. Nice. What makes this country so cool? And now, a word from New American Dream bowling writer Jeffrey Lebowski, Brian Williams' greatest lie. No controversy ensued when Williams and NBC colleague Tom Brokaw repeatedly upheld the Warren Commission's lone assassin conspiracy theory on November 22, 2013. NBC suspended Brian Williams for 6 months on February 10. The fashionable anchor admitted lying about being involved in a life-threatening combat situation while reporting in Iraq over a decade ago. Yet a survey of Williams' career indicates this isn't the first time he's been dishonest with the American people. In one important instance, while broadcasting from Dallas, Texas on November 22, 2013, Williams began the NBC Nightly News by remarking, "We're in Dealey Plaza, just across from the sixth-floor window in the Texas School Book Depository building, where three shots were fired 50 years ago today that changed the course of American history." The statement flies in the face of honest reportage by upholding a powerful myth devised by the Warren Commission that former U.S. Marine and intelligence operative Lee Harvey Oswald was the principal assassin in President Kennedy's murder. The American public can now point to overwhelming evidence presented by Attorney Mark Lane, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, the U.S. Congress, and a host of other researchers indicating that the three shots fired from the Texas School Book Depository was a CIA-contrived conspiracy theory. In fact, at least three sharpshooter teams killed Kennedy and wounded Texas Governor John Connally in Dealey Plaza in a triangulated crossfire. A few minutes into the November 22, 2013 broadcast, Williams segues to an outtake from a 1963 broadcast with NBC's David Brinkley, where Brinkley states, "The essential facts are these. President Kennedy was murdered in Dallas, Texas. He was shot by a sniper hiding in a building near his parade route. He was dead within an hour. Lyndon Johnson is president of the United States." Williams returns after the Brinkley soundbite to further emphasize the historical fallacy of a lone assassin, as if 5 decades of research and thousands of declassified government documents have not put the unfounded notion to rest. From November 22, 1963, just over 6 hours after the shots were fired from the building here behind us, meaning this place and this city and our country would never be the same. Well, thus, not only is Williams perpetuating a lie, one might safely conclude he's also a conspiracy theorist. And he's among the world's most famous journalists working at a major U.S. broadcast network that intends to bring him back after a 6-month hiatus for a second chance. Later in this November 22, 2013 broadcast, Williams introduced fellow NBC anchor Tom Brokaw, the same colleague he imparted his supposed combat exploits to in 2003. On November 22nd in 1963, Williams begins, Tom Brokaw was a young reporter in Omaha. He read the news of the assassination on the air, in fact. I think there was another element in all of this that helped us 50 years later remind each other about why we remember, Brokaw intoned. He was the first generational president who came along when television was pervasive in America. So he was a familiar figure to everyone, wherever they lived, in the big cities, small towns, and remote areas. And so when he was taken away at that young age, this dynamic man, it was a shock to the system because they felt that they knew him, not just as a president, but as a friend. Amazingly, after 50 years, Brokaw had yet to exercise journalistic due diligence by publicly questioning the implausible government cover story suggesting that Oswald killed Kennedy, nor did Brokaw take the opportunity to do so during this broadcast, thus perpetuating one of the U.S. government's greatest lies. Thus, two of America's most prominent journalists flagrantly misled the American public in this notable 2013 broadcast, yet no controversy surrounds their truly astounding assertions. Perhaps we need to ask, how differently would Williams or Brokaw behave as official press agents for the U.S. government? Brian Williams' deception points to a larger truth. A major career journalist's incorrect or embellished personal recollections are the stuff of controversy. In contrast, when it comes to the country's most momentous events, from the JFK assassination to 9/11, the war on terror, weapons of mass destruction, star journalists are compelled to spread and perpetuate massive lies. So long as those falsehoods are sanctioned and promoted by America's national security state, these celebs are allowed to proceed without question. Indeed, such figures are lauded for their journalistic service. The public be damned.
Our first guest of the night is Richard Flamer. Richard Flamer speaks with us each second week of the month from his home in Chiapas, Mexico. He and his wife operate the Chiapas Catholic Worker in conjunction with the Des Moines Catholic Worker. And Chuck will be getting Richard on the line about now.
Hello, Chuck.
Hello, Richard. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Oh, good. This week or this month, I decided on just a real simple goings-on in Chiapas. I'm reminded of Keith Fuller, Buckminster Fuller, once said that the real wealth of a country is in its ability to make tools. And tools are both the bane of my existence and the joy. A two-year-old boy was killed yesterday in our community. He was run over by a car driven by his uncle. He was interred this morning in our little cemetery. It's about 100 meters from our land in a simple service with a cross made of cypress by Juan, my carpenter friend, and myself. Because of the tools I have, we were able to crank it out pretty quickly. And Juan went ahead and carved the pertinent data on the cross. I'm getting ready to head out to Guatemala next week to buy and make arrangements to install a transformer in the carpenter shop of Yolan Bahosh. You might recall Yolan Bahosh is the Guatemalan community of repatriated refugees who have a carpentry shop that doesn't have any power to it. And they have all these power tools donated by an NGO in Switzerland, but they can't use it. I found a friend, an Austrian architect, who's agreed to pay the nearly $20,000 for the work on the transformer and the transformer itself. In the meantime, Victor came from Yolan Bahosh to stay with us a day and head for another NGO called Sue Niños. Sue Niños is a school for poor kids in San Cristobal, and among other things, they teach carpentry. In the 2 weeks that Victor has been there, he has learned how to run a table saw, a planer, and a joiner. And he has had lots of experience from Yolan Bahosh, but using only hand tools in building furniture and some structural stuff, mostly doors and windows. When the transformer's installed, Victor will be in charge of the carpentry shop, teaching others the basics. Meanwhile, I've been working with a man in England, Tony Merland, who runs an antique tool auction house. Tony volunteers at the local Salvation Army Center to check out all the tools, and with his brother-in-law, sends out a pallet of hand carpentry tools a year. That is, each set of equipment has a level, a saw, a hammer, a hand drill, the basic stuff one needs to do carpentry. This year, he's, along with his brother-in-law, has sent out a pallet of carpentry tools to Chiapas, well, actually to the Houston Catholic Worker. In the past, they've sent them to Africa, but they're now, this trip, or this year, they've sent out the pallet by boat to Houston, and then where I hope to find someone who can pay the shipping costs to get the tools to Yolande Bahosh. There are roughly 150 sets of hand tools, and I'd like to divide them up and give half to Sway Ninos for the kids who are graduating from the carpentry program, and the other half to Yolande Bahosh for them to start working in wood using the hand tools. I've also been busy with making contact with the Omaha Diocese on behalf of the school at Yolande Bahosh. They have an elementary school and what we would call a junior high at Yolande Bahosh, and really great teachers. But there's no way for the students to go past what amounts to ninth grade there in the community. There is, however, a high school in Huehuetenango, which is about 6 hours away by bus. So each year they've been trying to send four or five children to the high school, but it's a parochial school run by the bishop. And though they get half their costs paid by the bishop, the other half they need to try and find somehow amongst the families. But they're so poor that they haven't been able to send four a year. They've only been able to send one or two students a year. But this year, because of scholarships provided by the Omaha Diocese, they can send all four children. They're hoping that if this works out, the Omaha Diocese can fund the program for another 5 years so that 20 students can go on to high school. Additionally, we've been working on here at our house on an apartment, which is over my shop. But it's actually, the real reason for it is a laboratory for Araceli and her friends in Siempre Viva to produce oils and soaps and organic products. The project is coming along nicely, and Araceli got the money for it herself by applying for a grant, which worked out to be about $18,000 for her group. And so we've managed to finish the building, the basic building part of it. And we got the plumbing installed last week. And this week I finished up the electrical, and we've got a little gas stove in there and a bathroom and kitchen and a work area with a small room off to the side for a bed so that we can put up guests. And as I speak, we have three neighborhood children here. One's an 8-year-old working on homework as he sits in front of the fireplace. in a short sleeve shirt. Mind you, it's about 42 degrees here. His parents don't have money enough to buy him a sweater, so I've loaned him my little sweatshirt, which I found somewhere. We have a 15-year-old girl working at a board shaping rosemary-scented soap while she texts her boyfriend. The money she makes in with the soap, making the soap for RSLA, she puts towards her cell phone, which is one of those pay-as-you-go kind of things. The third child is 6 and also sits in front of the fire. Was his little brother who died yesterday. He doesn't want to go home because everyone in his house is sad. So Aerosol is making pizzas. We have plenty of hot chocolate. And I'm talking to you guys. That's what's happening in Chiapas.
Wow. Well, I'm so sorry to hear about the boy who was killed. And I really appreciate your painting us this verbal picture of what's going on there. It's just an amazing thing. We're nearly out of time, so before I ask you other things, I'd like you to mention your website and how people can help you guys out.
Well, we have the website is called, it's supposed to be the ChiapasProject.com, but there was a typo in there, so it's the Chiapas, Chaipas Project, all one word. And we can take in money from Holy Family Catholic Church, which is located at 1715 Izzard Street in Omaha, Nebraska, or to the Des Moines Catholic Worker, which you can find on anybody's website. I would mention, too, that I think the way things are going, we're probably going to go to the States, Araceli and I, for part of March and all of April, and maybe part of May, if we can find the money. So what are the questions do you have?
Well, when you were talking about the transformer and so forth, I wondered if you had tried a generator for...
Yes, we tried, and there's not enough power in the generator they have. See you next month on the radio.
And now, pull up close some flannel and some pie and a Lutheran. It's again time for your Lake Wobegon American Dream nap time story. America is Nazi Germany and worse because we don't yet know it is, and we have not yet hit bottom. But we persist in sleepwalking the American dream all the same. As George Carlin said, you have to be asleep to believe it. The St. Paul lawns are brown, not much snow this year. Garrison Keillor begins his soporific monologue last Saturday. Unseasonably warm weather, cats, and unused bags of ice melt. Lake Wobegon and Pastor Inkfist and Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility, the hopeful gospel singers. And why not? Why not lose oneself in fantasy in order to live one more happy day in America? Holding the door tight against reality with one hand while cutting the Thanksgiving turkey with the other? But we can't help but ask why. Why don't those with influence use that influence to tell us about what it is, what is real? Sure, they can do what they want with their cachet. Keillor has this immense talent and great idea and longevity. He can do what he wants, and he will. Well, of course. As well as the movie producers, technicians, musicians, artists, novelists, screenwriters, They put in the long hours for decades and just barely make it. And then when they do, why should they throw it away? For heaven's sake. This has been your Lake Wobegon American Dream Naptime Story. Sponsored by Jack's Auto Repair, Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, Bertha's Kitty Boutique. Also by the Sidetrack Camp, Bunsen Motors, Krebsbach Chevrolet, and Powdered Milk Biscuits. Heavens, they're tasty and expeditious. And now for another episode of The Lives of the Cowboys, we see John Belushi and the ISIS Deathmobile headed straight for Duke and Bubba Steve on the curb on Main Street and the cruiser in the middle of the homecoming parade. They leap out just as the Deathmobile smashes the front quarter panel. They land in the street and on the sidewalk as the car explodes. John Belushi, the ISIS leader, leaps above the flames, climbs the fire escape to the top of the Woolworth building. There he looks down up on the whole town, swooping his sword around. Bubba Steve sits on the sidewalk watching. Duke sits in the street looking straight up at ISIS Belushi, who has taken over the town. Dude, Allah effing Akbar, says Bubba Steve, ripping a pack of red Twizzlers with his teeth. I know, right? Says Duke. The Lives of the Cowboys, sponsored by Twizzlers in the bright red plastic. And this is Brian Williams with your nightly news that is the truth and is not made up. This is NBC News. We are the real deal. See our big offices, big salaries, big houses. We are really real journalists, really. President Obama just announced he will be bombing or attacking or torturing someone somewhere because it is the right thing to do. We have never asked, why are we there? What is our mission? We have never told the world what everyone in Washington, D.C. knows. Obama knows 9/11 was done by our own country along with Israel. He knows that. He knows we did not bury Osama bin Laden at sea. He knows that. We have never asked if the real reason we are in Afghanistan is the poppy fields, heroin, money. Is it ever about money? Only on very rare occasions. We know that Barack Obama is CIA, but everyone we know is CIA. It's not that big a deal. Flags the size of a Major League Baseball field and camo uniforms on the players. That's what we're talking about. And you, you old son of a bubba, we are counting on you to just sit there. That is your mission. This is NBC News. We are the real big deal. Big offices, big salaries, big houses. We are really real journalists. Really. And now for another episode of On Babushka Kalashnikov's Corner, the view from my pierogi court. Grandma Kalashnikov writes on her website her most recent column, Get Used to It and Live Your Life. Secrecy is the enemy of the truth. The reason so-called conspiracy theories exist is simply due to government-imposed secrecy forced by the military force and power of government on duped, unwitting citizens. End the secrecy and you will end most questions so long as government acts honestly and truthfully and scientifically and ethically. It is dishonesty and corruption and lying and cheating by government which leads citizens to use their constitutionally protected rights under the precious First Amendment to question such lying and cheating and evidently criminal acts by government officials paid by forced taxation of taxpayers. It is lying and cheating by government which sponsors all this. And now we get the anti-communist view from Uncle Bill's front porch.
Hello, Bill here. Modern propaganda techniques utilized by the corporate state to enforce anti-democratic and destructive policies routinely entail the manufacture and manipulation of news events to mold public opinion. And, as Edward Bernays put it, engineer consent towards certain ends. Such events include not only overt political appeals, but also acts of seemingly spontaneous terrorism and militarism that traumatize the body politic into ultimately accepting false narratives as political and historical realities. Western states' development and utilization of propaganda closely parallels the steady decay of political enfranchisement and engagement throughout the 20th century. Upon securing a second term in 1916, the Democratic administration of Woodrow Wilson plunged the United States into the most violent and homicidal war in human history. Wilson, a former Princeton University academician groomed for public office by Wall Street bankers, assembled a group of progressive left journalists and publicists to sell the war to the American people. George Creel, Walter Lippmann, Edward Bernays, and Harold Laswell all played influential roles in the newly formed Committee on Public Information and would go on to be major figures in political thought, public relations, and psychological warfare research. The sales effort was unparalleled in its scale and sophistication. The CPI was not only able to officially censor news and information, but essentially manufacture these as well, acting in the role of a multifaceted advertising agency. Creel's operation examined the different ways that information flowed to the population and flooded these channels with pro-war material. The committee's domestic organ was comprised of 19 subdivisions, each devoted to a specific type of propaganda, one of which was a division of news that distributed over 6,000 press releases and acted as the chief avenue for war-related information. On an average week, more than 20,000 newspaper columns carry data provided through CPI propaganda. The division of syndicated features enlisted the help of popular novelists, short story writers, and essayists. These mainstream American authors presented the official line in a readily accessible form, reaching 12 million people every month. Similar endeavors existed for cinema, impromptu soapbox oratory, the 4-Minute Men, and outright advertising at home and abroad. With the advent of the national security state in 1947, secret programs emerged where the people are, as a matter of course, intentionally left unaware of the state's true rationales and objectives. The U.S. economic provocation of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the Tonkin Gulf incident precipitating U.S. military occupation of Vietnam are obvious examples of such manufactured events. Similar techniques are apparent in the major political assassinations of the 1960s, where to this day the public is prompted to partake in the false reality that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole culprit in the murder of President John F. Kennedy, and Sirhan Sirhan was responsible for the death of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. In fact, in each incident, overwhelming evidence points to Central Intelligence Agency involvement in orchestrating the assassinations while training and presenting Oswald and Sirhan as the would-be assassins. The U.S. government's assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., probably the most influential African-American public persona of the 20th century, is not even open to debate, having been soundly proven in a court of law. Yet, as with the Kennedys, it is a genuine public relations achievement that much of the American population is oblivious to the deeper dynamics of these political slayings that are routinely overlooked or inaccurately recounted in public discourse. Along these lines, in the historical context of Operation Gladio, the Oklahoma City Murrah Federal Building bombing, the events of September 11, 2001, the London 7/7/2005 bombings, and lesser episodes such as the shoe and underwear bombers, the engineering of consent has reached staggering new heights where state-orchestrated terrorism is used to mold public opinion toward acceptance of militarized policing operations. the continued erosion of civil liberties and major sustained aggression against moderate Middle Eastern nations to cartelize scarce resources and politically reconfigure an entire region of the world. Again, the public is essentially compelled to believe that political extremism of one form or another is the cause of each event, even in light of how the sophistication and scope of the Oklahoma City and 9/11 attacks suggest high-level forces at work. If one is to delve beneath the public relations narrative of each event, the Newtown massacre and Boston Marathon bombing likewise appear to have broader agendas where the public is again purposely misled. Conventional journalists and academics are reluctant to publicly address such phenomena for fear of being called conspiracy theorists. The achievements of modern public relations are further evident in the Warren and 9/11 commissions themselves, both of which have spun the fantastic myths of Alan Dulles and Peter Zelikow, respectively, and that today maintain footholds in public discourse and consciousness. Indeed, the conspiracy theory meme, a propaganda campaign waged by the CIA beginning in the mid-1960s to counter criticism of the Warren Commission report, is perhaps as little known as Operation Mockingbird, the CIA program where hundreds of journalists and publishers actively devoted their services to spread agency disinformation. The overall effect of these combined operations has been an immensely successful program that continues to shape the contours of American political life and mediated reality. The present socio-political condition and suppression of popular democracy are triumphs of modern propaganda technique.
Our second guest of the night is Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer comes to us each month from Madison, Wisconsin. Chuck will get his, Jim sends a recording each month. Is the way that he does it, and Chuck will be getting that recording.
Back on with you guys again. Several events taking place here in Washington, D.C. are going to have considerable reverberations for the future. One is that John Bonner, the Speaker of the House, has invited Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, to address the Congress on the 3rd of March. Netanyahu is involved in a re-election campaign in Israel, but the fallout from this may not be quite what he expected. Indeed, Bonner, as the Speaker of the House, has no responsibility for the conduct of foreign affairs. The Constitution delegates that to the President with the advice and consent of the Senate. Netanyahu is very much opposed to the ongoing negotiations between the P5 plus one and Iran to constrain its enrichment of uranium. The whole business is a considerable piece of political theater, since our own intelligence agencies, all 16, concluded in 2007 that Iran was not pursuing a nuclear weapons program, a conclusion they reaffirmed in 2011. But Benjamin Netanyahu, who has the well-deserved reputation of being the Chicken Little of the Middle East, insists the bombs are falling. And even though there is no evidence to support that, and the official policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that nuclear energy for all, nuclear weapons for none, he continues to play this card over and over again. It's very much like responding to any criticism of the actions or policies of the government of Israel by claiming those raising them are anti-Semitic, when the two have nothing to do with one another. To be anti-Semitic is to discount the worth or value of a person or their opinion on the basis of their religious orientation or genetic legacy. criticizing the actions or policies of the government of Israel, such as its recent intrusion into Gaza, slaughtering thousands of innocent Palestinian women and children, which I addressed in an article in Veterans Today. I highly recommend what Israel regards as unimaginable constraint in Palestine may give you a dose of reality about what's actually going on here. In any case, to invite Netanyahu to speak in the midst of these negotiations has been met with a great deal of resentment by the White House. This is meddling in U.S. foreign policy. In my opinion, given the delegation of responsibilities under the Constitution, it makes Boehner a traitor, subverting the Constitution of the United States, which he swore an oath to preserve, protect, and defend from all enemies, foreign and domestic. That includes him. Benjamin Netanyahu's coming has also created considerable resentment within the Senate, whereas heretofore there had been virtual unanimous support for Israel. This has created a schism that will not soon be repaired, where, for example, 10 Democratic senators who were inclined to support increased sanctions on Iran, if the P5+1 negotiations were unsuccessful, have withdrawn their support. The fact is the sanctions themselves are a form of collective punishment of all the people of Iran for the this alleged actions of their leaders, which the Nuremberg Tribunal classified as a war crime, where the United States has made a practice of committing this war crime over and over again, most recently, for example, in Iraq, where the no-fly zone imposed there led to the deaths of some 500,000 Iraqi infants. What a disgrace when Madeleine Albright asked if the death of 500,000 Iraqi infants had been worth the imposition of the sanction. Cheerfully responded, oh yes, of course it had been. I mean, this is the depth of depravity to which the United States is sunk. And now Barack Obama is attempting to get an authorization for another commitment of American forces in the Middle East. We were suckers enough when we were played by the Bush-Cheney administration when 9/11 was a fabricated event brought to us by the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, most of whom were joint U.S.-Israeli citizens in the Mossad. There's a mountain of evidence to support it. Consider, for example, the website Israel Did 9/11 All the Proof in the World, or 9/11 in Zion, What Was Israel's Role by Nicholas Kollerstrom, or more recently Mapping 9/11, the Fort Lee Mystery by Gordon Duff, not to mention multitude of lectures, presentation articles by, for example, Alan Zebrowski, who has taught at the National War College, Christopher Bolin, who's wrong on the how, because it wasn't done using nanothermite, but right on the who and the why, where these events were intended to transform American foreign policy into one where we never attacked any country that hadn't attacked us first, into one in which we became the world's leading aggressor nation, invading Afghanistan in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and then on the basis of fabricated reports about Saddam Hussein being involved in 9/11, which was false, being in collusion with Al-Qaeda, which was false, attempting to develop nuclear weapons using yellow cake from Niger, which was also false. Now we have the massively trumped up, fantastic stories of ISIS, this Islamic State, supported by beheadings that are obvious fakes, and where I'm now convinced that even the immolation of the Jordanian pilot was another staged event. It's embarrassing, but when they have to fake these events to convince the American public something is going on. You know, we are being played. In fact, it wasn't that long ago that the Kardashian group was invented as a super violent extremist group in Syria that posed an imminent threat to the United States. What imminent threat? Have we forgotten about the Atlantic Ocean? And now this ISIS is supposed to pose an imminent threat. Well, I'll tell you what's going on. ISIS is being advised by two American generals. We have photographs of John McCain meeting with the head of ISIS in Syria, who's been identified as an Israeli agent. Saudi Arabia is supporting ISIS. This appears to be another completely contrived event to draw the United States into more actions in Syria, where you may recall Barack Obama was rebuffed by the American people when he wanted to lob cruise missiles into Syria in the wake of reports that Assad had used poison gas. Those reports turned out to be false. The threat from ISIS appears to be a fabrication. The President of the United States is lying to the American people once again. It's become a tradition where we cannot get truth from the President of the United States. He won't speak straight to the American people. And I'm very proud that Democrats in the Senate are turning against Obama in this rush to get war powers, even though his request to Congress was carefully worded to appease Democrats. Many members of the Democratic Party are abandoning him, which is completely admirable. The proposal put forward prohibits enduring offensive combat operations, but that's a phrase that can be stretched to mean virtually anything. How long is enduring? To have a needle stuck in your arm may seem to be an enduring pain, even if it only lasts a few seconds. And the idea that that should be interpreted as a ban on large-scale military army of occupation for an extended period conflicts with what we have done in Iraq and Afghanistan. Moreover, special op forces would be likely to be exempt from that provision. It's getting your toe in the door. It's another despicable act by a man who has intermittently done the right thing, just as he is now supporting the negotiation with Iran over their non-existent nuclear weapons program, and where he has been unenthusiastic about the forthcoming visit of Benjamin Netanyahu, where even Shimon Peres, the former PM of Iraq, has observed, if the president says no, don't go. And where Abe Foxman, who's the enforcement arm of the Anti-Defamation League right here in the United States, has said he thinks it's a mistake.
stock at Information Clearinghouse, Dandelion Salad, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and many others. Here is Phil Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Good evening, working stiffs. When will American labor connect the dots? A few years ago in Wisconsin and in two major cities in California, voters, made of mostly working folks, chose to restrict the benefit packages and wage increases for public service, a.k.a. government, employees. Now, some say that since most of the workers in these places and throughout America are employed by the private sector, the attitude became one of resentment. The private sector and non-union, in most cases, workers, were fed up seeing their public sector counterparts getting better benefit packages and wage increases. I call this interclass warfare, or maybe intra-class warfare. Sad, isn't it, when the less than 1% of our nation can create such divisions within the labor force? Yet, that was only part of the problem that this voting revealed. In Wisconsin, the voters chose to side with a right-wing governor who was candid about his goal to eliminate collective bargaining within the public service sector. Excuse me. This device cuts the legs off of the union movement, first with government workers and then copied by the private sector. Why was this all been happening? Well, the answer is obvious. Yet our mainstream media and even many union leaders refuse to recognize it. Former President Eisenhower labeled it the military-industrial complex, and as it has all but bankrupted our economy. Within 13 years, our military spending has just about doubled. In 2011, Mr. Hope and Change had the taxpayers charged 56 cents of every dollar we sent Uncle Sam for military spending. Never before in the history of our nation has it ever approached such an amount. We have close to 1,000 permanent military bases in more than 100 different countries. As you know, we illegally invaded and occupied Iraq and Afghanistan to the tune of over $100 billion a year. It cost us taxpayers $1.2 million to keep one soldier in Afghanistan for a year. That would pay the salaries of 30 teachers, police officers, or firemen at $40,000 a year each. Where's the outrage? Now, historically, our Congress was able to send money to the states for their budgets and their cities' budget problems. It was called revenue sharing. The money was sent to the states in the form of block grants, meaning it did not have to be paid back. Pretty good, right? Well, that ended with all our devotion to invading countries and occupying them. That all ended with the fear button being pushed down the throats of the public, as we now have with this ISIL, who, by the way, are made up of many who were left homeless or devastated by the Bush gang's illegal and shameful attacks on their native land. But both the Republican and Democratic parties have enabled the Pentagon and military-industrial complex to get more and more of our hard-earned tax dollars. Under the Democrat, Obama, military spending soared to more than $600 billion. And that did include many of the black budgets, which money was funneled into the military programs, which have no congressional oversight. It doesn't matter who occupies the White House. They all dance to the Pentagon Piper. The Congress and the presidency have been, for the most part, owned not only by Wall Street, but by this war empire. If only hardworking American labor force people would take a moment to ponder. If the CEOs of our Fortune 100 companies are earning in excess of 400 times that of their lowest paid full-time employee, shouldn't we have a society whereupon all working stiffs have good benefit packages and wage increases? Let's extend the conversation to say that all Americans should have the same medical and dental coverage that those CEOs have. I could go on and on, but let's leave it there. Oh, isn't it time for what the Wobblies envisioned over 100 years ago, one big union? The bottom line is this. If we cut military spending by even 25% and sent the savings back to the states and cities, there would be no budget crisis in any state or city, period. And for all my right-wing neighbors who bitch and moan about high property taxes, well, if more revenue sharing came back to our cities, perhaps then the property taxes wouldn't be so high. Stop supporting political parties and candidates who oppose such an idea. Thank you.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard.
And now a new American Dream radio show editorial comment. Let your life be a friction to stop the machine. Nightmare and insanity are akin. Mysterious and involuntary states that skew and distort objective reality. One wakens from nightmare. From insanity, there is no awakening. Whether Americans live in the one state or the other is the paramount question of this era. For 200 years, Americans have been indoctrinated with a mythology created, imposed, and sustained by a manipulating cabal, the financial elite that built its absolute control on the muscle and blood, goodwill, ignorance, and credulity of its citizenry. America began with the invasion of a populated continent and the genocide of its native people. Once solidly established, it grafted enslavement of another race onto that base. Once the existing oligarchy was secure in law and native people largely exterminated, the ruling class increased its wealth and power fantastically in the 19th century using the government as its enabler, exploiting to the limit the device of chartered corporations. With its phenomenal money power, the financial elite began to use the military to expand its sway beyond the continent. Regions, territories, islands, and whole countries were annexed, invaded, and possessed outright, their peoples crushed, suppressed, and ruled. Because ordinary Americans, like any people, need to believe that whatever the ruling elite undertakes in their nation's name must be essentially benevolent, noble in purpose, and justified in fact, the myth had to be radically modified for imperial expansion. The foundational story was that Americans had come to a howling wilderness, teeming with godless savages, and through invincible strength of character and purity of purpose, had tamed the land and honorably earned the right to possess their bountiful home. In the era of extraterritorial expansion, that version was polished to justify an ignoble imperialism. The new corollary was that America could not ignore colonialist brutality, but was obliged by the manifest destiny that led us to civilize our own continent, to carry our mission into barbaric darkness wherever tyranny created abuse and suffering. A national myth that absolutely binds the loyalty of a people to its government must be a subtle and powerful elixir that elevates and aggrandizes that people's self-regard. National policy will then appear to be an extension of its superior citizenry's inchoate will and the basis for a justified arrogance toward the lesser world. With World War II, the world was reconfigured. American capitalism emerged supreme from the horror that had virtually wrecked its capitalist partners. The Soviet Union had astonishingly risen above its ruin to become the leading challenger to America as a superpower. This challenge was not competitive, it was systemic. Soviet communism was a direct threat to American hegemony in that it categorically refuted the philosophical basis of predatory capitalism. Grounded in Marx and Lenin, it attacked capitalism's inherent evils, monstrous inequities, and flagrant injustices that, exacerbated by speculation, exploitation, and fraud, would destroy it. And it promoted world revolution to that end. This face-off of giants in the Cold War necessitated further refinement of the American myth. Now, instead of simply intervening in situations where despotism or tyranny required America to forcefully implant our just and ethical democracy, America had to become the shield and bulwark of the sacred capitalist system in which free enterprise was magically and increasingly identified with democracy and equally to be defended. This version prevailed through many surrogate confrontations around the globe in the era of mutually assured destruction and survived even the debacle of Vietnam, lasting until the collapse of the Soviet Union, as the propaganda stream became ever more intense and pervasive. As the propaganda stream became ever more intense and pervasive.
That's all, folks. That's news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. Stay classy, San Diego. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, have a good day. Be always awesome, and remember to tip your congressman. Our next guest is Susan Lindauer. Susan Lindauer is a radio commentator and activist. She's a former CIA agent. She spent time in federal prison following 9/11 for questioning the official story. She speaks to us from Tacoma Park, Maryland, and Chuck will be getting Susan on the line right about now.
Hi there, this is Susan.
Well, hello, Susan. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Hey, everybody. Tonight I want to talk with you about the CPAC conference in Washington. That is the Conservative Action Political Conference at the end of February, February 25th. And it will host such luminaries as Rick Perry, Republican, right-wing, fascist, Christian, who... if I may, I don't mean to offend anybody. You know that the Republican Party has accused me of believing in God, and that I was in fact locked up and told that it made me that it was a. I get very sensitive about Republicans on the question of religion. Let's just put it that way. But I want to back up and talk about CPAC because. We are looking at a 2016 race where CPAC is expected to anoint Jeb Bush to run, to head the Republican Party, to lead the way against the Democrats. And in my estimation, I am certainly not one to tell everybody who to vote for, but there is absolutely no way that the Republicans should put up Jeb Bush for the White House. It would be a catastrophe, bar none, for this country if that were allowed to happen. We have a very short memory in the United States, but it is, let us not forget that it is the Bush family that gave us 9/11. It is the Bush family that gave us the Patriot Act. It is the Bush family that gave us the Iraq War. It is the Bush family that gave us the lies of the war on terrorism. It is the Bush family who used the bureaucracy to commit crimes against the American people. And by that I mean, speaking from personal direct experience, we're talking perjury, obstruction of justice, felony prosecutions where the prosecutors should have been sent to prison for the perjury that they were telling in a courtroom. At the very least, they should have been disbarred. We have a crisis situation now. If Jeb Bush were allowed to take the Republican nomination in 2016, we would be throwing this country into a nightmare of self-destruction, downward spiraling malevolence towards the American people, especially because the elite are so afraid of the people already. And these Republicans, and I realize that there may be Republicans out there who may be listening to this broadcast, who may be so dismayed to hear what I'm saying to you tonight. They may be very upset to hear these words spoken because they hate Obama and they are imagining that the Republicans have the answer, but they don't. This is the problem. There is no natural Republican leadership. John McCain, Rick Santorum, are you kidding me? Michelle Bachmann, the whole Mike Huckabee. I mean, we cannot replace one set of mediocre leaders with another set of mediocre leaders. But especially we cannot allow anyone in the Bush family ever to return to politics leading this country. We might as well just forget, you know, just break the country to pieces right now and just take a sledgehammer to the Constitution, because these people run the government for their corporate friends. It is, they run it for Halliburton. They make no secret about this. Why do you, my friends, think that the Republican Party exists to promote your interests unless you're already part of the 1% and the corporate elite of America on Wall Street? They don't. They don't care about you at all. They only need your vote. And having worked on Capitol Hill and having known people, congressional staffers who worked for Senator Grassley, Senator Bond, many other Republicans, they freely say that they do not want people to vote. They don't want to be beholden to anyone. Just stay out of their way. They will take care of the country, and they don't want to hear from the people at all. They are the worst leaders of all. They are the most disinterested in us. We, the people, don't count. And I know this is going to hurt, you know, my Republican friends are going to say, Susie, we want to get rid of Obama. You're going to get rid of Obama. Obama's going to be gone. This is now about a vision for what we're going to do with this country. And we cannot have a vision that includes any Bush. I don't care if it's a cousin of a Bush. I don't care if it's a son, daughter, transgender, Hispanic, Asian. I don't care. There can never be, after what they did to this country on 9/11, in the pursuit of a war with Iraq that was very easily won, we could have achieved every goal that we had without firing a shot. It is impossible to tolerate those people back in power. It cannot be allowed to happen. And so all of you who are interested in the CPAC, who think, you know, people have been calling me. You know, I'm kind of dismayed because people are calling me saying, hey, do you want to go to CPAC? Oh, wow, this is going to be so great. The American Conservative Union and the Conservative Political Action Conference. Oh, this is going to be so great. We're going to take back the White House. We're going to put Jeb Bush in there. Oh, Lord, young Americans for Liberty, please. It cannot be allowed to happen. The Republicans are going to have to start thinking of the middle class if they want to be in power. They're going to have to start thinking about the 99% if they want to be in power. And the first way to show that is to dump the Bush family. Because those people it's intolerable for those people to keep reemerging in political life. I would take 5 Hillary Clintons before I would take 1 Bush. And let me remind you what they did on the Patriot Act. This is going to become a big issue. The fact that they knew about 9/11, the fact that their own Bush allies in the Saudi royal family financed 9/11, even the corporate media for the past 2 weeks, the corporate media has been covering this, acknowledging that the Saudis and the Bush family together have you know, the historical defenders of the Bush family are the ones who put this thing together with their own money. Who you know, even if we don't, and I'm not saying that 19 Saudi hijackers went in and did 9/11. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there's financial backing for the greater 9/11 conspiracy. It takes a lot more money to do it the way Bush did it than to just jump on an airplane and hijack an airplane. That's not what happened. We all know that. The problem is that a lot of people, even in the 9/11 community, are willing to overlook that so that they can have a Republican in the White House. And so that's why I'm saying to you right now, all of you need to realize that if the Republicans want to have a serious candidate, then they better start looking outside of the Bush family. Because Americans, I will fight to, I'll tell you right now, I will swear to God above, I will fight to the death to stop Jeb Bush from getting into the White House. It is absolutely, it's just intolerable. I'm still in the shock phase. And I know what's coming. They're all going to line up behind Bush. That's what this is all about. Oh, Susie, come on, join our bandwagon. No. No, I won't. And if I'm the last one in the 9/11 movement to say that it's evil and wrong and foul and vile and against the United States and that these people are traitors, one of the worst things that Obama did was to refuse to prosecute them. They should have been prosecuted for war crimes. They should have been prosecuted for crimes against the American people like me. Crimes against using the bureaucracy. The worst part of the Bush administration is that they use other bureaucrats, nameless, faceless bureaucrats who have with no transparency, no accountability to the people, and they use those people to break the laws and to harm and damage their opponents, to harm and damage dissident voices. These are the people who are so threatened by freedom of speech that they, the Republicans, the Bush family Republicans, criminalized free speech. And they are the ones who all of us have to fear. Obama is too weak to implement martial law. The Bush family is so vicious and contemptuous of the principles of American democracy. They're so contemptuous of little people that they are it's very easy for me to see exactly what will happen. We are going to have a financial crash. And at that moment, do we want there is no way that we should allow a malevolent leadership defending the elites to run the government. So I think I can hear my clock going.
The clock is about up. Question.
Thank. Okay.
It's great tonight. Great.
And now we have a guest commentary from Carl Olson. Carl Olson is an application developer for Drake Technology Services at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. He successfully petitioned the Iowa Board of Pharmacy in 2010 to make a unanimous recommendation that marijuana be reclassified as medicine in Iowa. Olson maintains that state reclassification is an essential step in getting marijuana reclassified federally.
Hi, this is Carl Olson with Iowans for Medical Marijuana, and I've got an update about what's going on here in the state of Iowa, which is similar to what's going on in other places around the country. In 1971, our legislature adopted something called the Uniform Controlled Substances Act. It was part of a national effort to reorganize the drug laws. And marijuana was placed in this category that's more restrictive than opium plants and coca plants. And the idea was that marijuana had no accepted medical use, and obviously opium plants and coca plants were being used to make morphine and cocaine. Since that time, there has been 23 states have enacted laws accepting the medical use of marijuana. And just last year, another 11 states enacted marijuana extract laws that don't provide any legal way of obtaining the extract because marijuana continues to be in both state and federal Schedule 1, which is that classification. Opium plants and coca plants have been in Schedule 2 since the creation of this new set of federal and state drug laws. So besides that fact, the Iowa Board of Pharmacy is designated by our statute to do an annual review of the classifications and recommend changes as needed. And so I felt like they were kind of ignoring their responsibility, and I filed a petition with them in 2008 In 2009, they held a series of public hearings and took evidence for 4 months, and they reached a unanimous conclusion that marijuana has accepted medical use, and it should be transferred to the same schedule as opium plants and coca plants. And while that was going on, the American Medical Association also made that same recommendation, and they explained that Schedule 1, the current classification, is making it too difficult to do research. Well, our Iowa legislature has ignored that, and so last year when we enacted this cannabis extract law or marijuana extract law, there was no there's no means of obtaining it. There's no way to legally get it. It can't be made in Iowa. It can't be legally made anywhere in the United States under federal law. If you want to go get it from a drug dealer, you can go get it. And once you get back in Iowa with it, you're immune. If you have intractable epilepsy and a recommendation from a neurologist. So in November last year, December last year, the American Academy of Neurology recommended that we take marijuana out of class one, saying it's making research too difficult. And again, in January of 2015, just last month, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended that we take marijuana out of Schedule 1 because it's making it too difficult to do research. So that brings me up to date where we need to get the legislature to enact this change in the classification. And I don't know what state you might be in while you're listening to this, but you probably have a similar situation in your state. If you have marijuana classified, as many states do, as having no accepted medical use and treatment in the United States, that may not seem important, but when you think about the fact the federal Schedule 1 actually prevents marijuana from being used for research, that it's very difficult to get, that law makes it so only one manufacturer can exist, and that's the University of Mississippi. They grow all the marijuana for research, and you have to get a special FDA approval for your research project is not sufficient. You also have to get a permission from the National Institute on Drug Abuse to get some of this marijuana that's in short supply because it can only be manufactured at the University of Mississippi. So if you're not aware of all of that, think about it. We're working on it here, and have a great day. This is Carl Olson with Iowans for Medical Marijuana.
And now a message in a Boone's Farm bottle, some notes that I've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From Natasha in Novosibirsk, North Dakota. Russia is preparing the release of evidence of the involvement of U.S. government and intelligence services in the September 11th attacks. In the list of evidence includes satellite images, published material, and prove the U.S. government complicity in the 9/11 attacks, and the successful manipulation of public opinion. The attack was planned by the U.S. government, but exercised using a proxy so that an attack on America and the people of the United States looked like an act of aggression of international terrorism. The motive for deception and murder of its own citizens served as U.S. oil interests and the Middle East state corporations. From Boris in Frostbite Falls, the evidence will be so convincing that it utterly debunks the official 9/11 cover story supported by the U.S. government. Russia proves that America is no stranger using false flag terrorism against its citizens in order to achieve a pretext for military intervention in a foreign country. In the case of the September 11th attacks, the evidence will be conclusive satellite imagery. If successful, the consequences of Putin's tactics would expose the U.S. government's secret terrorist policies. The government's credibility will be undermined and should bring about mass protests in the cities, leading to an uprising, according to American analysts. A message in the Boone's Farm bottle, some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth is a microbrew of what is going on everywhere, where the people fight to have some sort of say and leave it to the outlaws to come up with something. Leave it to the guys in the jails and carrying skateboards, leaning up against the light pole at 2 a.m. to come up with something. It's the home of Piker McNugget, Carol Kopecky, Frosty Pine, Winnie Bloodfeather, some 23 Toy Bonans, Diamond Griffin and Penny Jones, families from Minneapolis and St. Paul and St. Peter and Mankato and Des Moines, thundering up Interstate 35, hit full throttle on Friday afternoon, accelerating past Hinckley and Sandstone, past Pine City, Barnum, Cloquet, to get away, to let their hair down, to get bugs and branches in their hair, to turn your phone to vibrator, leave it to the, into the ditch, grenade style, change your radio from WCCO to the Moose. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer, and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag, it's the bomb, it's the gold. We continue our story. We meet Billy, sitting on the hillside, overlooking the big lake, sitting by himself, thinking his own thoughts.
He stretched out his feet in the coarse, dry grass and let his weight go back on his hands on the big rock. It was the first time he'd been here. But he was calling this the Big Rock forever, and he would always sit here and look over the land and watch and keep all his guys safe. Billy the Kid's eyes bounced wide. He sucked his breath in like he was a museum, and it was the last one on Earth that the tail end of a black something disappeared into the hole in the toe of his tennis shoe sitting next to him on the rock. Billy set his hand on the kitchen knife in his belt. The breeze played with the grass, and he felt them on his toes, the gremlins and little bits, invisible except for the moving of the grass. The little bits' spirits found plenty of room in the large space between his big toes and his next ones. Billy stared at his toes. Some kids said he had some tard in him, and he'd pounded them or tried to. They ran. The regular kids were German and Irish and Dutch and some other stuff. Billy was tired. Attachment disorder, ADD, ODD, a bunch of other crap. The wind carried the smell of the big lake, and it tasted like pancakes on his tongue with brown syrup. They must be having some on the ship. And now the smell and the taste ran around and between his toes, like kids chasing each other on playground equipment. Billy froze, leaning, hand on the knife, a wild animal, with temerity and deception its only weapons. If you see them, they'll stand and stare at you like they'll kill you. But they're really nice. He sat and he watched, one eye on the shoe, the other on the big boat. A big boat sliding over the water, coming this way. You could hardly tell it was moving, it was so big, and the lake was so enormous, and it had come so far. But if you looked away and then back, then it moved. But it would not move while you were watching. Ships were smart. Billy was not. He was not. The salamander stuck its head out the hole in Billy's shoe. Its black head with yellow spots and a line running down the middle of the head toward the back made it look like a poisonous baby space alien skunk. It did. It scrambled over the rock and over the edge like an alligator diving out of a plane. And it was gone into the white flowers. Billy looked at the ship then without moving his head, just his eyes down to make sure the creature was gone and then back to the ship. The big red ship could be from a long way away. Iowa or Canada or the cities. Or from wherever he was born. And there could be all his family and friends and knew him back then, and they would tell him who he was, where he was from. And they would say they'd been looking for him, and they were so sorry, but now that was all going away. They were here. Good feelings, and an end to all of this on that ship. And it's coming, and it won't move if you watch it. You have to look away and then back. Away and then back. Away and then back. He waited, jiggling his toes, not feeling his numb hands, white from pressing down. Seagulls zipped like flying Z's around Billy's head, and they swooped, and in a minute or a second they were above the highway, way down the hill, and then one more half a second they were above the water, then the bridge. And they were out of here! So easy. Billy was stuck here. He'd never get away. But he would. Just like he got away from everywhere else. They'd never catch him. He got away from that last place, and this place, well, no place could hold him. He was Billy's goddamn kid. He shot a look behind him and ducked down, peeking over the brush. He looked to the left and to the right. Nobody coming. That was good. Nobody was coming. No friends, no brothers, no sister. No mom to say your breakfast's getting cold. No dad to say, let me drop you at school on my way to work, bud. The morning traffic on Interstate 35 moved like Christmas lights on a conveyor escalator belt. And if you stared hard for just an instant, they looked like a string of lights around the porch of an emergency shelter. And every once in a while, one is missing, or two. You never got a full string. There's always something wrong. He felt the knife, the thin, loose black handle, the bent blade, the dull, ridged edge. The staff would miss it from the knife drawer when they counted, and he'd get sent to outer space placement. Well, they couldn't send him any farther on Earth. This was the ocean. That's it. Those people in the cars had weapons. Not knives sneaked from a rotten group home kitchen drawer. They had all the weapons in the world, and Billy had none. Staff had rules and paper, more paper with court typed in at the top. Billy had his red cape from his Walmart plastic bag, and from everywhere else he could remember. He couldn't fly anymore off the dining room table like he used to when he was little, but he still had the goddamn cape. And he had a stinking orange peeler in his belt like some retard outlaw. He had his feet and his hands and his eyes and his brain. That's one thing they for sure didn't know. His secret weapon, boom! When they don't even expect it. Boom, boom, boom. Billy the Kid drew his sleeve back and yanked his shoulder around to see if it was still there, the ink pen tattoo he'd drawn in the bathroom mirror after they said he should go to bed in his new group home. He climbed up on the sink and put his shirt over the light, then stealthily placed a color picture on the counter, the picture he'd ripped out of the encyclopedia in the library on their last group outing. He was leaving anyway. Still had the tape on it, and it lay nice, flat on the counter so he could see. It was a fish. A walleye. It looked just like one. If these kids here saw he had a real walleye tattoo, they would know he knew his way around up here, and they wouldn't mess with him. He was in big trouble. Again. Can't have tattoos. No ink. He read it in the rules they always make you read. He pulled his shoulder way over again to see where he'd drawn it backward in the mirror. It was mostly right. Good enough. Better than any of the other boys. They didn't have any fish tattoos at all. Probably. He felt his arm. He felt how big his muscle was. He flexed his hand, his throwing hand. They'd never take it from him. He touched the knife. Over there above the trees, he saw stadium lights. They weren't on or nothing. That's another thing. They go to ball games at this new group home, and he was going to learn baseball. Somebody would teach him. And it's 1, 2, 3 strikes. Billy sang the song his mother used to sing. The old ball game. 3 strikes, you're out. Baseball is so stupid. Sometimes you had to smile and pretend you're interested in things when you're really interested in something else, and keep that thought. And it'll help you do the stupid stuff so you can get to the important stuff. Billy was in big trouble. And it wasn't ever going to stop unless he stopped it. That's what the counselor in Burnsville said. It was all up to him and his attitude and what he did. It did not matter what people did to him or said about him. It was how he reacted, his response. That's what really mattered. Bull. Billy repeated in his head the part from the encyclopedia that he used to have on a ripped out sheet taped to his concrete block wall in his bedroom somewhere. Various accounts recorded by friends and acquaintances describe him as fun-loving and jolly, articulate in both his writing and his speech, and loyal to those for whom he cared. Billy looked around, left, east to Russia, right to Minneapolis to St. Paul. He twisted to see behind him up the hill. If anyone came right now, he would run to Russia and be against the United States. They didn't like him anyway. Billy stared into the breeze, letting the oil and gas and smoke from the waterfront burn his eyes. He closed his eyes and rubbed them. His stomach gurgled. His nose dripped a little. Billy wasn't Billy the Kid. He was Marcus Aurelius Romulus. Jesus, Pete Christ. What his birth mother named him. That's bull. It can't be his real name, or she must have been really stupid, because that name didn't last more than a few hours and Billy got out in the world. He had to figure out somebody else to be quick to survive. It was in some stupid school. Billy was sitting in a corner, stuck there by the stupid teacher, and all the stupid kids were all twisted in their desks. And he was staring back at them like some stupid kid in a zoo. He stared at them until they turned around and the teacher told them to turn around. And then he tried to listen to what the teacher was saying. And she said he was not part of this class and to just sit there. So he looked away. He looked around, all around him. There were wood chips for the real furnace they had back there that they never used. And he turned all the way around and found about 100 old textbooks they never used, and workbooks and dust and ancient cookie crumbs and mouse dump and other stuff. And he saw this huge shiny book and he reached for it, and he could only reach one hand, and he got it and pulled it toward him. It fell a little and made a bump sound, and he stopped. No motion, so they wouldn't see you or they'd forget you. He waited. They'd forgotten him a long time ago. And he kept pulling on the big book until he got the whole thing in his lap. He could read better than anyone in this stupid classroom could, but like some of the Mexican kids like to act like they didn't know English just to keep the United States kids and the teacher a little off balance, hold something in reserve, keep an advantage so it might come in handy, survive at the last moment. Billy kept that mostly to himself. He read the cover description of Billy the Kid, the outlaw with a heart and pockets filled with gold. He read it a few times and then began to turn the big shiny pages, not too fast in case somebody was watching. Never let your guard down, kid. Not even, especially when you think they're all your friends. That's when it's most dangerous, kid. Kid, you don't got any friends. Remember that. Remember that. You'll live a couple minutes longer, maybe. That wasn't in the book. Billy stared at the pages. He'd stopped reading to consider a thought that had come into his head. He tried to remember the older boy who told him that. His mind flashed 100 faces and a dozen group home and foster home images on his mind movie screen. He couldn't remember. Some big kid, a black boy. No, some white kid. Some big white kid with long black hair and 2 homemade tattoos on his arms. Clouds on one bicep and a bolt on the other. Thunder and lightning. Billy snapped back into his earth body and head and recalled where he was. Kept his head down. Sensed whether anyone was looking his way. Heard the teacher talking and some kids whispering. Not about him. And kept reading about the real Billy the Kid. His many friends did not view him as a ruthless killer, but rather as a defender of the people who was forced to kill in self-defense. And right there in that stupid classroom with his head down and his breathing carefully controlled so his shoulders didn't even move and not letting anyone see the smile on his face, Marcus Romulus Shithead became Billy the Damn Kid. He gulped a breath and held it, practicing in case he was ever underwater and had to swim away a long ways while gunshots zipped in all around him like cliff divers.
That's the news from Duluth, Minnesota, where all the police and soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that just about wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for listening. We hope you'll be back next Thursday and every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Thanks to our guests, Bill Ferruccio, Jim Fetzer, Susan Lindauer, Richard Plamer, and Carl Olson. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to the show.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.